Well, hey there, folks. You got some records that need cleaning? Well, of course you do. Every record should be cleaned before you play it, which is why you need a record cleaner that won't break the budget. And for that, I urge you to turn towards the Groove Washer. Groove Washer is the best record cleaning bang for the buck, with vinyl kits starting at $15 and bundles like the big Groove Washer bundle that will sort you out for years. GrooveWasher.com has record cleaners for every level of the vinyl hobbyist and collectors. Whether you're a vinyl novice or mega nerd, head over to GrooveWasher.com. And guess what? Here's a 10% off coupon for anything at GrooveWasher.com. Enter promo code VinylGuide10 at GrooveWasher.com and bask in the fact that you did well, son. You did well. That's GrooveWasher.com, promo code VinylGuide10. That's the Groove Washer, proud to be made in the USA. And with that, please enjoy today's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Hey there, this is John Doe, and you're listening to The Vinyl Guy on The Vinyl Guide. Oh my goodness.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey everyone, it's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for downloading. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in, turning on, and dropping the stylus on this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. And hey, all you American listeners, I hope you had a good and safe Memorial Day. I hope you took the opportunity to spin some records and enjoyed the long weekend. Look, today, super short upfront announcements. I'm going to get straight to our special guest, Mr. John Doe of the band X, who are celebrating their new LP, Alphabet Land. Vinyl copies can be ordered at xtheband.bandcamp.com. Now, most of you know that X are one of the seminal LA punk bands, alongside the Weirdos, the Screamers, Germs, and that crowd. They were even on the Danger House record label, which John and I talk about today on the show, along with the recording of the X debut album, Los Angeles, which is a record that I reckon every listener should have in their collection. Now, today, John and I walk through the X vinyl history, along with John Doe's own solo records, which are also available on vinyl. I'll put links in this episode page. It's a great conversation with a fantastic songwriter and artist, and I am so glad that X is back in business. The new album, Alphabet Land, is the first time this classic X lineup has recorded in some 35 years, and man, did they hit the nail right on the head. Alphabet Land is also an album that wasn't supposed to be out yet. However, due to the coronavirus shutdowns, the band and their record label decided to let it go early, and he tells us the story about that decision today. And look, I, for one, am glad they made that decision. I've been enjoying Alphabet Land the last couple of weeks. It's very refreshing and very much welcome with all the things that are happening in the world today. By the way, can I quickly interject here that we are brought to you today in part by GrooveWasher.com, the best record cleaner on earth. Head over to GrooveWasher.com, get 10% off with promo code VinylGuide10. We are also brought to you in part today by AudiophileUSA.com, the online record shop that sells only excellent and near mint vinyl records, over 42,000 titles and shipping worldwide. That's AudiophileUSA.com. And finally, we're also brought to you in part by Seams Easy Record Jacket Repair Strips. Fix your record jacket seam splits with the Seams Easy Strips, available at SeamsEasy.com. And by the way, if you enjoy this episode with John Doe, check out these other episodes of The Vinyl Guide, including episode 184 featuring Glenn Matlock of Sex Pistols, talking all about the early days with the Pistols, the recordings, the vinyl, and more. That's episode 184 of The Vinyl Guide. Episode 145 with Chuck Dukowski of Black Flag and SST Records. Episode 107 with Jake Burns of Stiff Little Fingers discussing the punk scene in Ireland during the Troubles. Episode 104 with Bad Religion and Circle Jerks guitarist Greg Hetson. Episode 39 featuring Tesco V of the Meatmen and Touch and Go Records. And most recently, episode 209 with Waddy of the Exploited. And episode 223 with Minutemen and Stooges bass player Mike Watt. Plus heaps more at thevinylguide.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get these goddamn things. Alrighty, enough of the chit-chat. Let's talk about the history of X, from Danger House to Fat Possum, from Los Angeles to Alphabet Land, featuring our special guest, Mr. John Doe. Today here on The Vinyl Guide, we have Mr. John Doe celebrating the new X album, Alphabet Land, available on Fat Possum Records. And of course, you can grab one at xtheband.bandcamp.com. John, I'm really excited about this new album. I've been listening to it the past few days, a great record. And I understand that it wasn't even supposed to be out right now, but much later in the year. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. It was supposed to be late August, early September. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, 2 weeks after we mastered it, Fat Possum got in touch with us and said, "We don't know. Nobody knows. What the hell? And let's put it out right away. We'll just put it, we'll be punk rock and indie and put it on Bandcamp for 10 days. And then you can, then it'll be on streaming services and people can pre-order vinyl, et cetera, et cetera."
And I'm sure that fired up the old endorphins there, yeah?
It took us about 5 minutes to say yes. You say, you know, first your head like spins around a couple times, like Linda Blair and the Exorcist, and then you go like, "Fuck yeah. You mean we don't have to wait?" Because that's always a frustration. You know, you finish something and then you got to wait for all the, you know, BS mechanisms to get in place and blah, 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 blah. It's like, do it.
Everyone's waited 35 years for the album, and now all of a sudden it gets sped up and the decision's made in 5 minutes to release it right away.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, there's a lot of precedent for that, you know, with people just like dropping records, Radiohead and Beyonce and, you know, crap like that. And it felt good to be in the company of Fiona Apple. You know, she's cool. Yeah, I mean, why not?
Oh, and the plan seemed to have worked. I mean, you know, I think you guys sold out of vinyl in the first few hours or something crazy like that.
Oh, they made some collector's item colored vinyl. No, that was like 15 minutes, but it was only 500 copies. I mean, geez, if you can't do that, what can you do? But it's cool. You know, they did like three colors for collectors from the record company, and then they did another color for all the indie record stores. And it's, you know, people like collecting stuff, and I'm for it.
Mm. What do you think of the popularity of vinyl coming back over the last few years? Does that surprise you at all?
No, because I prefer that. It is a weird thing though, because you do have to master things specifically for vinyl. Mm-hmm. And some mastering labs and mastering engineers won't do that, and that's bullshit, because I've done it both ways. And if you don't do a specific mastering for vinyl, it's actually worse than a CD, because you've got to kind of like a challenging medium of the, you know, vinyl disc and stuff like that, and a record needle and all that crap. So if you don't adjust for that, you have to find somebody who's done it and who's older and understands it. But yeah, I love it, because I love, you know, from when I was a kid. But I don't get too nostalgic about it. If, you know, any way that you can listen to it, it's cool.
Well, look, I don't have a vinyl copy of the new album yet. I've been listening to it on my earbuds, but I can't wait to hear it in a proper stereo system in a controlled environment when I could actually sit down in front of some big speakers and enjoy it.
Yes. Well, I haven't listened to it on vinyl either. We're still waiting for test pressing. So.
Oh, okay.
Supposedly in late August or middle of August, they're going to be sending them out.
No one was prepared for it. No one's expecting the.
Man, I mean, it's hard. It's, and I'm consider myself incredibly fortunate that I don't have to rely on a weekly paycheck or rely on a weekly gig down at the honky tonk. But man, it's my heart goes out for people that have that, and I'm just consider myself really fortunate, and I hope that people like us that can hang on for a little while do to flatten the curve and also are a little bit more grateful for what we got, you know, when this is moves into its next phase.
Yeah. Well, so I'm in Australia, and the discipline that the population has had here has been really impressive. And we've now got to the point to where I think in the whole country right now, as of today, 98 deaths. So we're still holding below 100. And so they're starting to now kind of open things up, and everyone's been on their best behavior. So I certainly hope that the U.S. or certainly big parts of the U.S. can kind of work it out. And it's not going to be as bad as everyone feared.
Oh, you're so hopeful. I love it.
I could put that out.
Not going to happen. Sorry, Nate. Don't tell me what to do. I'm an American, damn it. My president said it's okay, so shut up.
You're taking away my freedom from keeping me from Chipotle.
No shit. Ay, ay, ay. People.
I know.
Let's talk records.
I know. Look, I'm an introvert. This is a disaster perfectly made for me.
So, yeah, I know.
So what were the records of your youth? When you were young, what were the records that that you had in your collection?
Well, I'm of an age that I was like in grade school when the British invasion and you know, like the second wave of rock and roll happened. So my first record was Yardbirds record. 45 of For Your Love. And I rode home on my bicycle and unfortunately wrecked on my bike and the record cracked. But being the sort of ancient technology that it was, you could just sort of click it back together. So there would be a little pop as that crack went by.
Right.
Played fine. It was no big deal.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
And so that was the record what you saved up. You knew you were going to get when you went to the store. You heard on the radio and you said, I got to get me one of these.
Yes. Oh. But the first record that I wanted and I tried to convince my mother to buy for me was Lonely Teardrops by Jackie Wilson. And she thought it was just, oh, he doesn't really want that. And I was like, no, really. I want that. So I felt good about that. But, you know, it's just being of a certain age and people have nostalgic feelings about that stuff, whether it's, you know, Kiss or you know, something, some other not as good band. Garth Brooks. my sweetheart, who's a bit younger than I am, she remembers her first concert was going to see Garth. She comes from Texas. Mm. Was going to see Garth Brooks in a mall parking lot. Mm. And there were like 3,000 people there or something like that.
That's very Texas.
Yeah.
Were there some records that you remember that had a really strong impact on you as a kid? Even the, you know, the music that made you think, wow, this is something I want to do.
Well, the ones that had impact were folk records. Cause again, this is in the like late '50s, early '60s. For some reason, a murderer like Leadbelly was deemed appropriate for children to listen to. Hmm. And I wanted to be Leadbelly. I still do in some way.
Without the police record. Yeah.
Well, no, I'd rather not have that. I'd rather not have killed somebody. But if that goes with the territory, that's the way it goes.
That is a well you could draw on. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston. And there was a guy who was actually, a biology teacher whose name was Sam Hinton. And he was kind of a folklorist. I loved his stuff. So that was when I was a kid. And then probably, you know, I also loved musicals. I loved like The Music Man and Bye Bye Birdie and South Pacific and stuff like that. So, that was my upbringing. But then probably teenage years, it was psychedelic music. That was when I was probably 16 or something. And that's when I started playing bass and started singing and thinking I could, you know, you see people on Ed Sullivan, you think, oh, that looks like a cool job. What if I did that? You know, but I wasn't really serious about it. Mm-hmm. Probably till I moved to LA when I was in my early 20s.
And when you went to LA, was it for purely for music, purely to kind of gamble on what the next part of your life was going to be? Or did you have a bit of a plan going to school, anything like that?
No, I'd already finished school. And I wanted to be in music and I wanted to get the hell out of Baltimore, even though Baltimore was really instrumental in my love for like bohemian existence. I knew John Waters and a couple of his actors kind of tangentially. I mean, John and I had a few conversations here and there and we sort of remained friends. And they were just available. You know, it was like, God, these are celebrities, but they're just like regular people. They go down to the bar. And I used to play at a place called Bertha's for tips with another friend of mine. And they would hang out. Mary Vivian Pierce, who's so just so exotic and like an orchid or something. And Edie had her thrift store, Edie's shopping bag right next, like two doors down. And Edie just be hanging out there, you know, with their gap teeth and her, and like, ha, honey, how you doing? You know, it was awesome. I moved to LA because I'd seen some bands up in New York. That's where my parents lived at the time. And I'd seen Heartbreakers and Talking Heads and CBGBs and Max's Kansas City. But I was just sick of the East Coast, so I wanted to go to L.A. for fun.
And when you went to L.A., and obviously you had, you know, the aspirations to get into music, it sounds like you pretty quickly fell into the local scene, what was then the first wave of Southern California punk rock, the Plugs, the Screamers, Germs.
Yeah.
When I think of that era, I seem to think of the records that, you know, I would imagine early punk bands had and agreed on, you know, Ramones, Stooges, MC5, but that's not really accurate, is it?
Part of it is. I mean, we also listened to a lot of old rock and roll records, Little Richard and Chuck Berry. Mm-hmm. But I would say, yeah, like The Idiot. That Iggy record that was on everybody's turntable. So was the Modern Lovers, that first Jonathan Richman record, because it was just so basic and primitive, and then just a bunch of other weird 45s. You could find like old country western 45s or LPs in thrift stores for 10 cents, and our our poverty dictated a lot of our fashion and our musical education. But it was, you know, David Bowie and Mark Bolan, they were big influences, and I listened to them back in Baltimore, and so I was pretty familiar with that. And but we were also just influencing each other, playing live and listening to each other live. I remember the Damned being the first band that came to Los Angeles. And they were amazing. They were just so, so powerful. And they still are. We played with them a couple of, 6 months ago or something like that. Probably 9 months ago.
So were they one of the first punk bands from overseas to play in Southern California?
They were one of the first punk bands, period. I think the Ramones came hot on their heels. Mm-hmm. But that was early 77. Also, Blondie played with Tom Petty at the Whiskey, and they were scheduled to play two shows. They didn't sell out either one of them. And the Whiskey is like maybe a 500 cap place, and so they invited the audience to stay for the second show. There were probably 250 or 300 people there, and television came through, and not the Talking Heads, I don't think. But, a lot of New York bands came during 77. Once it had kind of people had figured out you could get over here. But there really wasn't much in between. You know, we drove to New York in early 78, drove across the country with our gear and played three shows in New York and then drove home. Yeah. Insane. Because we didn't know. There was no play. There was no, like, network. It was like, I don't know. Where do you play in Chicago? No fucking idea.
So you got connected with David Brown and Pat Garrett, who founded the Danger House label. I always picture again that time as being incredibly creative, and the Danger House record label and its eclecticism really seems to me to be proof of that. How did Danger House operate?
or not operate?
Yeah. How deep was their dysfunction?
Yeah, what was their dysfunction? They just were ballsy enough to say, okay, we're going to make a record company. And Black Randy would just talk people into it. And nobody really cared because there were very few other alternatives. You know, there was Greg Shaw with Bump Records. And there was Chris, oh God, what was this? With What Records. And that was about it. You know, and Danger House seemed to be the kind of nobody else was interested. So it was, I mean, it was incredibly frustrating because we knew that we weren't going to get any money. They paid for the recording, which probably cost them $1,000 at the most. And it kind of sounded like that. It was, you know, it was very eclectic. And I give them a lot of credit for just saying, I can do this and who gives a shit. But similar to indie, all indie record labels, they didn't have a clue. They had no business sense. They had no plan. They were just, you know, flying by the seat of their pants, and good for them. I'm proud that we did it. It was, you know, after we realized that they were talking shit behind our backs, then we said, maybe we don't want to work with these guys. And by then, Slash Records had started, so...
Was Danger House getting involved with them? Was there a lot of DIY? I mean, you guys having to glue the covers together or package them together, or was that all done kind of offsite? And
yeah, they took care of that. I mean, that was maybe we didn't feel equipped to do that. I give SST and Alternative Tentacles and, you know, Discord and people like that, I give them a lot of credit for taking that hit. Yeah, maybe we were too old fashioned to think that somebody else should do that. You know, we weren't as DIY as SST bands. We weren't really willing or interested in sleeping on people's floors in sleeping bags. We were, you know, we were older. We were in our 20s, not in our teens, and we weren't willing to just drive across the country to spread the gospel, which we have done. But yeah, we were on a different kind of plane. We felt we could get away with, and we did.
And Slash seems to kind of be that next phase record company in the area that really had the capital and the business sense, at least early on, to be grabbing bands like Germs and Fear and you guys as well. How did the deal with Slash Records come about?
Oh, I don't know. Just because we knew all the people at Slash Magazine. Okay. And then Bob Biggs came into Slash Magazine and realized that he could possibly make records. It wasn't a lot of finances, and they didn't have a great plan. They had some distribution through a really weak company called Gem. And you'll excuse me because this is so much, so much history. I'm trying to rack my brain, but yeah, we experienced all that stuff that you see in Spinal Tap where you go to the in-store appearance in 1980 and there's nobody there, or you know, in the Midwest, someplace in the middle of nowhere. Or you go to another record store for an in-store in like maybe 81 and there's there's no records. There's 30 or 40 people there and there's absolutely no records to be bought because the distributor didn't have their shit together. So yeah, it's a little frustrating.
Yeah. Well, I think you guys were Slash release number 4 or something. So they were still just working things out. The first album, Los Angeles, produced by Ray Manzarek. How did the relationship with Ray start?
He saw us at the Whiskey A Go-Go and, he had read an article related to the lyrics. And when he saw us at the Whiskey, I think it reminded him of the relationship that the Doors had with their audience, in that there wasn't a lot of separation between the two.
What did Ray teach a young John Doe?
Oh, not to use studio tricks. To just get an honest recording, get a good performance. And if something sounds, if you play a part of a song and it sounds good once, then try playing it twice in a row and it might sound better.
Oh, okay.
I still use that. And an example would be the opening to Los Angeles. It has four chords and it, you know, or three, and then it hits the root chord. And Ray said, that sounds good. Let's try it twice. And so we still play it twice before the song starts.
When you entered the studio, I'm assuming you had all the songs pretty well collected, all the ones you were going to record. Did you have a lot more material that you had to cull down?
Yes. We had probably half of the Wild Gift record written and rehearsed. We've been playing for 3 years at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, we started in DJ Bonebreak, our drummer, joined in, I don't know, middle of 77. So we started recording the end of 79, I think. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we've been playing these songs for a couple of years. And I give Ray the most credit for choosing the songs on Los Angeles. I mean, we all weighed in, but he said, these are the songs that I think stick together the best. And some were newer, some were older, but songs like Adult Books or We're Desperate or I'm Coming Over, they had already been written. We've been playing them, but they didn't seem to fit the same kind of, I don't know, feel that Los Angeles had.
Now, the song Los Angeles is so intertwined with your career. I'm sure you've played it 20,000 times in your life. Does it still mean the same thing to you when you play it as it did when you wrote it in 1979, 1980?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's a song that stars a character who starts going off the rails and becomes racist and has to change. And it also reflected my love for how weird the town is, how separate I don't know, separated it is. Mm-hmm. And also my appreciation for Charles Bukowski and his style of writing. At this point, we don't use the N-word when we're singing. We've changed it to, she started to hate every Christian and Jew.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, at the time writing it, I was holding a mirror up to people and saying, hey, this word has power. This word is really wrong and messed up. And guess what? It still means the same thing, but it's worse now because it's, you know, 40 years later.
Yeah, I would imagine during your career, you probably, especially in later years, you probably got some flack for that. People just not understanding that it's a character you're talking through.
Yeah. I mean, not really. A few younger people, like friends of my daughters, might have raised an eyebrow, but didn't really, you know, that's one of those things. People don't say it to your face. They just think it. And then we realized that it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago that it was becoming problematic. And so just to avoid, mm-hmm. Controversy, to not, you know, I don't want to piss people off in that way. I want to piss them off in other ways, but I don't want to be on the wrong side of that conversation. Mm-hmm.
Now, in recent years, you've actually left Los Angeles, moved to Austin. Could you really relate even closer to the story of that song?
Oh, no, because it was such different circumstances. I mean, I moved out of LA the end of 1980, mm-hmm. or the beginning of 1990, and then lived up in the mountains about 100 miles or 75 miles away from Los Angeles for 20 years, and then moved to Bakersfield for a few years, and then ended up in the Bay Area for about 10 years, and have only been in Austin for about 3. So it was, I lived in California for plenty of time. But I liked it. The Bay Area was a little cold. So, and we have a lot of friends in Austin. So I moved down here.
In terms of the Los Angeles album, moving on from that, went into Wild Gift. You continued working with Ray Manzarek really for the next several albums. So that was a very close relationship you had with him as a producer. In terms of the contributions and the way he worked with you, what are some of the things that are important for a record producer to keep in mind when working with a band?
With him, and I think that depends. It depends on the band. It depends on the personality of the producer. Mm-hmm. But with Ray, he was incredibly encouraging. He kept his eye on the clock so that we got done what we needed to get done. We never went over budget. We never went over the time that we were going to do it. And our budgets were small. The first record was 10 grand. The second record was 20 grand. They were both made in about, 3 weeks, something like that, 2 to 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And we made this record in a longer period of time, but about the same amount of time in the studio. I think that's all you really need is maybe a month,
right,
to make a full, 10, 12 songs. And he just got great performances. He said, just try it again. And I don't know, just experiment with it. And he, he had a lot of uncapped thinking. He was open to things, but kept you moving in a direction that you already were moving. He didn't try to reinvent something to prove that he was doing his job. And that's something that I've seen producers do. And that's kind of, I've even done it, and that's kind of bullshit. Don't fix it if it isn't broken.
Now in Alphabet Land, you worked with Rob Schnapf.
Yes.
This is the first time I believe the band has done that. Was it difficult bringing someone new into the fold?
That's one of the reasons that it took us so long to make a record or to get things in place so that Maxine and I were willing to put the time and effort into beginning to write the songs. Mm-hmm. Rob actually mixed X live in South America, which was some recordings that we made with Pearl Jam when we toured with them. And Billy has a very particular way that he wants to have things recorded and how he works. And I mean, we do too, but Billy keeps us honest in that way, and we respect his opinion, even though we may disagree. And once Rob was available, and I'm a big fan of, Elliot Smith and I were pals and a big fan of his work, and also Cat Power. And those are two people that Rob's worked with a lot. Mm-hmm. And, so we started out by recording three old songs and one new song in February of 2019. And when those sounded like us and we figured, well, we know these older songs, we've never really recorded them, so let's refresh our memories and bring them up to date but not mess with them too much. Mm-hmm. And then when we got a new song and they were all mixed, and we thought, well, what the hell, this sounds just like us, this sounds good, let's go for it. So probably April of 2019, Xena and I started working more diligently on writing the songs.
Okay. Did you have it in your minds at one point you would record another album? I mean, it's been a while since the last one. I mean, how long has this been in the planning?
Well, the last record we put out was 27 years ago, and that wasn't with Billy. Right. This is 35 years since we recorded a record with Billy. Xene was pushing for us to record probably 6 or 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. maybe even when we were touring with Pearl Jam in 2012, but we just couldn't figure it out. We couldn't figure out who to work with and how it would be released. And then when Fat Possum came along to re-release the first four records, because we had reclaimed the masters, then we thought, okay, there's one thing. And then Rob Schnapf came along. Okay, there's another thing. And then you don't really have any, you've run out of excuses. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if there was a grand plan, but Xena has been the champion of getting us back in the studio.
It sounds like having a new album was important to her.
I think it was important to all of us once we realized that we could do it. Mm-hmm. And I didn't actually understand what kind of a record we were making until I got the SoundCloud file of it and could play it from beginning to end. And then I realized, oh shit, this is good. And I'm glad that I didn't write any real slow songs. It just moves along. And that's something that our fans and people that don't know us can use right now. It's something that's, you know, can allow you to jump around the living room if you want to do that. Even though the lyrics have some weight to them, the music is still very upbeat and pretty catchy.
It's fun. It's sharp. It's to the point. It's under 30 minutes.
Right.
In terms of the album, is there a theme or a narrative for Alphabet Land?
There's no high concept. It's not a rock opera. However, our current situation has reverse engineered the theme. And there are themes that we've talked about in the past. It's a culture or a country or a person that's on the edge. It's people in a moment of crisis, and talking about subjects that are timely. And that was, I think, one of the things that Fat Possum and we agreed on that it should be released now. Mm-hmm. And it's unintentional. But it happens when someone close to you passes away, or you get your heart broken, and you're listening to the radio, or some song comes on, you go, oh my God, that speaks to me, because you're in this vulnerable place, and that's how art is supposed to work. It's supposed to open you up and make you, you know, more human. We're having a little bit of a spillover benefit from our current situation. I wish it wasn't, but we'll take it.
It's a good time for this record to come out. I've certainly enjoyed it. Were you happily surprised at how well it's been received?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you never know. And I don't read reviews. People tell me, oh, this is good and that's good, and they said something, because I've learned my lesson. yeah, it's great. It's you feel validated. You feel as though your work hasn't been in vain. For me, the main reason to make something is so people get enjoyment, maybe some enlightenment, or they feel something they thought in the past or they felt in the past, and they go, yeah, that's the way I would have said it if I did.
So everyone's happy at this point with the reception. Do you think this is now going to be a potential open door to more work with X?
The dam has been broken, Nate. I guess. I mean, like we did, so yep. Why not? But it's a little bit like when you go to a city that you haven't played in a while, and you just finish the gig, and then every time, you know, before you leave, someone goes, so when are you coming back? It's like, I don't know. We just got here, man. So we just played. It was really rewarding. It wasn't easy. Because staying in that intuitive place when you're making a record is one of the hardest things to do. Don't let your mind, and maybe this is something that Ray taught us, you know, don't let your brain overrule your heart and your intuition, because an intuitive decision is always better than some logical decision.
But I guess in terms of, I mean, it's been so long. I mean, there had to have been some nerves and some uncertainty going into it that has now been vindicated.
Yes and no. I think we got over that on the first batch of recordings. You know, we did four songs at the beginning and then did a few, you know, did the rest of them afterward. Having said that, since we're different people, at this point, the difference was that I got over my ego. And so if some chords didn't work on a verse, I'd just try to find some other ones. Or Billy would suggest to leave out one of the chords. And DJ would play a drum beat that would lead us in another direction. And so it was a lot more collaborative, which we worked out mostly in the rehearsal room, not in the recording studio, because you're on the clock there. Yeah, and I'd say that was the biggest difference, is that everybody showed up and everybody, you know, had respect for each other and didn't get in the way of, like, well, this is the way it was written. It's like, who gives a shit? Does it sound good? Does it, you know?
So you mentioned earlier that you've been able to reclaim the masters. Do you now control all of the X music?
In the process of, it's a 25-year, and it has to be released for 25 years, and then you can reclaim it.
Okay, so I think what Jesus maybe is the one.
Well, there's Ain't Love Grand, which was the last one we did with Billy. I don't really like the way that record sounds, but I'd be willing to put it out under protest. And that was the first record we did without Ray. And then after that is See How We Are, and then Jesus. But they'll all eventually come out.
Excellent. I hope. And I'm sure Matthew and the Fat Possum team will be very helpful in that regard, hopefully one day.
Yeah, you know, they're really nimble and they're forward thinking. I mean, when we signed with them, they said, look, this is going to sound weird, but all we really care about is streaming revenue. And if we can increase your streaming numbers, then we've done our job. And we thought, yeah, but you don't get paid for that. But it is a measure of the impact you have and your longevity. That's smart. That's smart for, you know, for guys that started releasing, you know, started their record company with Junior Kimbrough and fucking R.L. Burnside. He's like, what?
No. Now the focus is on X, obviously, with the new album. In terms of the solo projects, are you still working, writing, and still intending to release further solo albums?
Yeah, I have an idea that I got like three or four songs that apply to it. And I've been trying to be motivated to work on solo songs. So yes, that hopefully will be, I don't know, maybe next year. Mm-hmm. And that was the biggest difference, is that when I do solo records, then I'm the boss and I'm kind of the main producer. So I had to step back on this. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that I did. On the X record, I had to step back because I probably would have added more bits and pieces and frills and, you know, stuff like, oh, let's put something in there during the chorus. Let's put a counter melody and let's do this and let's do that. But Rob and Billy were and DJ to an extent were adamant about keeping it economical and just letting the space, allowing the main tracks to have as much weight as they could. And that's, you know, less is more and be economical.
And is that a strange position for you to be in, of letting go of a lot of that and being part of a team more so than an individual?
Yeah. I mean, when I work on solo stuff, or if I'm producing somebody else's record, I allow everyone who's been cast to make their contribution. I rarely tell people what to play. It's just kind of filling in spaces. But yes, I have learned to check my ego and to step back, especially when you're equal parts. But yeah, I think it's a waste of time to play with someone and not take or not allow them to contribute the reason that you got them there. You know,
they're there to express their greatness. So yeah, you'd be a fool not to let them do it.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I mean, I've seen that happen, but Yeah, it was, I think that's why we got the record that we did on Alphabet Land. And the other thing that came along the last 5 years was the two books on LA punk rock, and I'm very happy that those are out and kind of set the record straight as far as like who, how, and why. And for LA punk rock, the first book was from say 77 to 82, and then the second book was 82 to 87. So it covers 10 years of kind of indie music in LA, and it's the story that I could, you know, find people to tell and tell myself. So there's room for other people and other books, but I'm glad that at least that's down there and in libraries and things like that.
Yeah, I really liked how you you had different people write different chapters, so it wasn't just one view being stamped across the book. So
I couldn't tell the story of what it's like for women to play an equal role. I couldn't tell the story of what it's like for people from East LA to come into this punk rock Hollywood scene. I couldn't tell a lot of those stories, but I could be the narrator and give those other writers a topic that they were expert in and let them tell that story.
Exactly like being part of the band.
Yeah, I'm a good collaborator. I like working with people.
So I'm glad you brought up the books, John, because I'm about to tell everyone that they can go over to The John Doe. That's The with two E's, thejohndoe.com. You can get John's books there. You've also got some vinyl up there. There's the Westerner LP, A Year in the Wilderness LP. There's also the Best of John Doe This Far. That is a two album set. And I believe the records are free shipping within the U.S. So even you could still practice your social distancing and everything, do the right thing, and the records and the music will come to you. Also, you know, I'm sure most of you guys already know X has a new album, Alphabet Land. It's great. It is available at Fat Possum Records. Grab a vinyl copy, order one. They have several pressings, several colors, several variants, and they are constantly selling out. So if you get a chance to grab one, do it. You can go to xtheband.bandcamp.com. And John, thanks again for really all you do. Thanks again for thinking of us and releasing this album early at a time that we really sorely needed it. And Godspeed to you, man. You know, long may you run.
Thank you very much, Nate. And you can also get them from your indie record store, or you can order the books from your indie bookstore. And please try to support your venues that are closed, and take care of yourselves. And we'll see you hopefully in the near future.
There we go. Mr. John Doe of X. What a legend. He is welcome back. John, you are welcome back anytime you want. I really enjoyed that conversation. And again, everyone check out the new X album, Alphabet Land. It's available on Fat Possum Records. Of course, you can grab a copy at xtheband.bandcamp.com. And I'll put some other links here in this episode page. And man, thank you again, John, for coming on The Vinyl Guide. Alrighty, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. If you enjoyed the show, I would implore you to consider becoming a patron of The Vinyl Guide at patreon.com/vinylguide. You go up there, a couple of bucks a month, really helps out your buddy Nate here. And of course, you get a bunch of extras, early access to episodes, extended interviews, secret episodes, and more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. And if you can't do that, then please share this episode on your social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever. And please write us a positive review on Apple iTunes or Stitcher or one of the podcast services that you use. That would be much appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.